Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Today, Derek Seidman unmasks some of the sleazy corporate connections behind mainstream environmental organizations, and Marshall Auerbach talks about useless tax cuts for corporations that already have more money than they know what to do with. Before getting to all that, just a few words on the Federal Reserve's decision to cut its main policy interest rate by a quarter point the other day. Markets sold off in the news because, as a Bloomberg headline put it, you call that a rate cut? What a bunch of ingrates. That the Fed is cutting at all, with the unemployment rate below 4% for a year, and the stock market very richly valued, is enough to make the heads of veteran observers spin. And for the president to express disappointment that Fed Chair Jerome Powell made it clear that this was not the beginning of a lengthy and aggressive rate-cutting cycle is remarkable. But we pretty much lost all capacity for surprise. It's not clear what this rate cut is supposed to do, except maybe keep the stock market from selling off, and it doesn't seem to be doing that. It's not going to raise wages or improve job quality or, God knows, forestall climate catastrophe. And it's certainly not going to placate Trump, who spent his entire business career borrowing gobs of money and defaulting on it when convenient. That also seems to be his approach to governance, insofar he has any approach to governance. What a splendid time to be alive. On to my first guest, Derek Seidman, an analyst with Little Sis, as in the opposite of Big Brother. It's a project that's mapping connections among elites. As they say on their website, we help answer questions such as, who do the wealthiest Americans donate their money to? Where did White House officials work before they were appointed? Which lobbyists are married to politicians and who do they lobby for? And in this case, what are the ties between some of our leading environmental organizations and the fossil fuel industry, as well as the banks that help finance them? Perhaps surprisingly, perhaps not, more intimate than you might imagine. Here's Derek Seidman with more. So you might think that Big Carbon and the environmental organizations would be in opposition, but you would be wrong to think that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, absolutely. It's unfortunate that you have a number of high-profile purported environmental organizations that actually have extremely close ties to the oil and gas industry. We're talking about some of the really big ones that most people who, you know, might not know about who's sitting on their board think about when they think about big environmental groups like the Environmental Defense Fund, the Nature Conservancy, the New York League of Conservation Voters. And these organizations promote a, you know, much more moderate, market-friendly environmentalism. They have very close ties to corporate America, banks, real estate, and the fossil fuel industry. They tend to stand apart and sometimes antagonistic towards more grassroots climate activism that you might see with, say, something like the Sunrise Movement. And all in all, yeah, they tend to promote like a more corporate-friendly, market-friendly environmentalism.
Okay, let's name some names here. And I should say that Liza Featherstone did a piece about this for Jacobin, so I want to just touch on this. And people want to know more, they can read that. But there's plenty of other bad guys to work with here. But the New York League of Conservation Voters, you would think, well, by the name, it sounds kind of like old-line, you know, maybe upper-class Republican conservationists. But that's not really what they're all about, is it?
No, the New York League of Conservation Voters is a particularly egregious example of how the fossil fuel industry really has direct lines to some of these groups. So just to give you a few examples, the chair of the NYLCV's education fund, and their education fund is sort of like their public engagement wing. The chair of it is Ed Cox. Ed Cox is the longtime chair of the New York GOP, though I think he's being phased out of that position right now. He may have already.
Yeah, he was not right-wing enough for the New York GOP. And he's also Richard Nixon's son-in-law.
Exactly, yeah. And he recently announced that he was joining the Trump campaign, to the Trump 2020 campaign. So you have, you know, the chair of the NYLCV's public engagement wing actively working to reelect maybe the most anti-climate president, not maybe, the most anti-climate president in American history. Cox is also, since 1984, he's been a member of the board of Noble Energy. Noble is one of the big powerhouse oil companies in the U.S., centered mainly in the Permian Basin in Texas, which is the most, you know, the most productive oil field in the world right now. They're just drilling away over there. He's earned millions of dollars as a board member. In the most recent proxy statement of Noble, he took in something like $320,000. So that's just one example. Another angle at looking at this is that in talking about the New York League of Conservation Voters is that there's been a few major battles in New York State over the past few years in where the climate movement has been trying to stop the build out of new infrastructure that's going to be burning fracked gas from out of state. Some of these projects have been the Dan Scammer gas plant and the Millennium Pipeline, two separate things, both in the Hudson Valley, and the Williams Pipeline, which being in New York City, I'm sure you know a bit about.
Yeah, I mean, I've gotten community. We have get our gas from National Grid, and they've been sending us threatening emails. We won't be able to expand without this pipeline.
Right, right. Yeah, that's one of their scare tactics, even though people in the movement against it have you know, been able to show that it's not necessary. The New York League of Conservation Voters has multiple board members who are actively working for the companies behind these projects. So where on the one hand, you have the whole climate movement in New York State essentially opposing these, you have the New York League of Conservation Voters having a whole host of governing board members that are working as lobbyists, that are working as spokespeople, that are working as attorneys for Millennium Pipeline, for Williams Companies. Michelle Hook, who is a regional board member of the New York League of Conservation Voters and used to work in the Cuomo administration, is not only the spokesperson for Millennium Pipeline, but also the spokesperson for Dan Scammer.
How does the New York League of Conservation Voters relate to the national one?
You know, I think it's important to state that the League of Conservation Voters, National League of Conservation Voters, is not as bad as the its New York affiliate. From what I know, the National League of Conservation Voters has, you know, supported some good things, and it's not as closely tied to the industry necessarily as the New York League of Conservation Voters is. I don't know how much closer you could get than the NYLCV. But I think it's significant that the New York affiliate of the national organization is, you know, allowed to stand as it is, because the conflicts of interest are just so egregious, and the greenwashing couldn't be any more clear. You literally have representatives of the fossil fuel industry on the board who are actively working for oil and gas projects at the same time that the New York League of Conservation Voters is not opposing these very same projects. Just to go back to the examples of Williams Pipeline, Millennium Pipeline, Dan Scammer, I did a site search on the New York League of Conservation Voters page. There isn't a single inkling of anything, no opposition from the NYLCV, nothing around these projects, which, again, have really been core campaigns to stop of the environmental movement around New York State for years.
Okay, let's go on to some of these other malefactors. Environmental Defense Fund, as I was saying to you before I pressed the record button, I recall, I don't know, it must be 15 or more years ago, that EDF worked with McDonald's to redesign its packaging to be, you know, less wasteful. But then McDonald's could say they're EDF approved. It all seemed deeply cynical to me. But that was just a portent of many things to come with EDF, right? They like to rent out their imprimatur.
Yeah, I think that the EDF prides themselves on working with corporations and working with business to try to advance environmental goals. I think that's an extremely wrong-headed strategy for many reasons. One being that the oil and gas industry, its main purpose is to extract and burn fossil fuels as much as it can until it can't. And insofar as it does work with purported environmental organizations in some sort of alliance, it's doing that to further its own motives and burnish its reputation as being, you know, sustainable or caring about green issues or something like that.
Now, they're also giving cover to pseudoscience around fracking, right?
Yeah, so yeah, I'll get into some of the other things about the EDF a little bit more. They have long given the stamp to studies around fracking that are sometimes tied to universities. At Little Sis, we call this fracademia. These studies are tied to the industry. In several of our reports, for instance, with studies that were put out by the University of Texas Austin, by the University of Buffalo, which had to be retracted, the studies themselves are very faulty. They reach conclusions that are just not true. There's people behind the studies that are tied to the industry, and the EDF serves a role as reviewing them and saying positive things about them. And so, you know, then the industry can go off and use these things. Another example is we did a report several years ago, and I'll highlight the work of my colleague, Rob Galbraith, about on this, on something called the Center for Sustainable Shale Development in Pennsylvania. I think it might have changed its name since then. But this is a center that was basically an alliance between major fracking companies in Pennsylvania and a couple different environmental nonprofits, including the Environmental Defense Fund, that essentially provided certification for fracking companies that they were responsible drillers. And most of the benchmarks that they needed to pass were just basic things that fracking companies need to do, say that they're doing anyway, like not dumping wastewater into Pennsylvania's water and so on, right?
But all the chemicals they use inevitably leak into the groundwater.
Yeah, absolutely. It seems like every week we're finding more and more about the horrible health consequences of fracking in Pennsylvania. For instance, there was just a big study that came out of the Pittsburgh Gazette that the levels of an extremely rare cancer in southwest Pennsylvania that's a big hub for fracking are just astronomical. And it seems that they're tied to the fracking industry. And, you know, the governor's going to have to appoint a commission to look into it.
That phrase sustainable fracking is just surreal because, leaving aside the intense environmental damage that fracking does, it's not very sustainable even as a source of energy. I mean, these wells, they drill them and then they quickly run dry, so they have to drill more of them. There's nothing sustainable about it by any measure.
Yeah, that's a big problem, and there's a big fracking bubble right now. The fracking industry has incredible amounts of debt because they just need to keep it going. They just need to keep drilling more and more, and the longer you drill, the less productive the wells become. It's a big bubble, as you say.
Now, the Nature Conservancy, again, that name Conservancy, it sounds very old-line, you know, like George H.W. Bush-style Republican country club is environmental, which might be perceived as weak, but the Nature Conservancy board is really quite a collection of ghouls.
Yeah, one of the persons that really stands out to me on that board is Larry Fink. Your listeners might know that Larry Fink is the head of BlackRock. Yeah, I don't know if it's the biggest, but one of the biggest asset managers in the entire world. And it's, you know, one of the top investors or top shareholders, I should say, in virtually every major fossil fuel company in the world.
I'm speaking with Derek Seidman, a research analyst with Little Sis. Okay, aside from the personnel on these boards, let's talk a bit about what industry, in conjunction with some conservative and centrist polls, are doing around the Green New Deal. So, you know, the Green New Deal has certainly attracted a lot of attention and has caused distress in America's boardrooms. So what kind of mobilization is the fossil fuel industry doing to counter the thing?
I think that you're seeing a broad response to the Green New Deal that's coming from the fossil fuel industry, but not just the fossil fuel industry. We put out a report recently called the Anti-Green New Deal Coalition. At the center of this coalition is the oil and gas industry. It's incredibly powerful. It has billions and billions of dollars. It has the Republican Party, which operates as its de facto political wing, and it wants to crush the Green New Deal. The softer side of its campaign against the Green New Deal is that it's trying to promote natural gas as a bridge fuel that's lowering emissions. So, for example, the Western Energy Alliance, a lobbying organization for the industry, put out a press release once the Green New Deal talk got going, talking about how great natural gas was in reducing CO2 emissions. You also have the industry lining up behind a market-friendly carbon tax. So, for instance, there's an organization called a campaign called the Climate Leadership Council that has a lobbying wing in the United States called Americans for Carbon Dividends. Companies like Exxon and Shell and ConocoPhillips have donated millions of dollars to its lobbying campaign for a carbon tax. They're doing this in a very self-interested way because they're worried about lawsuits and they're worried about more intense regulations that might come if there isn't something like this. So that's one thing that the industry is doing. They're trying to sort of preempt the Green New Deal. But you also have, you know, a whole host of centrist Democrats who take money from the fossil fuel industry, who are hostile to the bold, we might say, social democratic vision of the Green New Deal. And along with establishment economists like Janet Yellen and billionaire influencers like Michael Bloomberg are trying to pose a more, what they might say, realistic, market-friendly path towards reducing carbon emissions than something like the Green New Deal.
And then the banks are also part of this. I mean, they finance the carbon producers, and then now they're also financing PR.
Oh, absolutely. I think the banks are really important to pay attention to, because the fossil fuel industry is not going to stop burning fossil fuels. That's what it does. And it's trying to buy as much time as possible and burn as much oil and gas as it can. It's the main driver of our climate crisis. But the fossil fuel industry's ability to function rests on the banks. And the banks are an integral part of this sort of big greenwashing apparatus. So, for example, the Bank of America, which is the fourth biggest financier of fossil fuels, the fossil fuel industry in the entire world, it was a corporate sponsor of the recent climate summit last November that Jerry Brown and Michael Bloomberg co-hosted in San Francisco. It has a partnership with the Nature Conservancy. I think it's had that for decades. Going back to the New York League of Conservation Voters, Citi, which I think is the second or third biggest financier of fossil fuel industry in the world, their sustainability director is on the board of the New York League of Conservation Voters. And those are just a few examples. I could keep going on.
What about the role of Michael Bloomberg? I mean, he's interesting in several ways. I mean, he, in some sense, you know, he's as mainstream political figures go, he's done drawn more attention or paid more attention to climate issues than most. But then he also is kind of involved in this greenwashing side of things. So what about the measure of Bloomberg? What do you make of him?
I think he's an interesting figure. And I should say one more thing about the New York League of Conservation Voters. One thing it's been criticized for also is that it's a pass-through for donations. So several years ago, Michael Bloomberg gave them $350,000, and it was reported with the intention that it was going to go to supporting Mark Grisanti, who was a pro-fracking representative in Western New York. But that's a side point. With Bloomberg, on the one hand, wants to sort of sell himself as a global green hero who goes around the world as an ambassador at climate summits and, you know, pours tens of millions of dollars into trying to get the U.S. off coal, which, you know, that's a good goal. But on the other hand, he is on record. I mean, he's written these words himself in books and op-eds, talking about how much he loves fracking and he in natural gas, and he's a big supporter of these things. It's widely believed, and we've documented as well as we can, that Willett Advisors, the firm that manages all of his wealth, is invested in oil and gas. It seems like it's possible he may be getting a little bit better when it comes to that now. I've heard some things recently about how he wants to move beyond supporting natural gas as a bridge fuel, but I can't comment on that too much just yet. But I will say that, you know, I think one problem with Bloomberg is that he tries to position himself as a standard bearer of a more corporate-friendly, market-friendly, responsible environmentalism. And he directly positions himself, like, in contrast to, say, AOCE and the Sunrise Movement and those types of people in organizations that are promoting, I think, an environmental vision that is also wrapped up with tackling inequality and racial inequality and such.
I guess we should not spare some unions from the withering critique, right? There's some unions playing a good role, but some that are playing a rather bad role in climate politics, right?
Yeah, it's a mixed bag with the labor movement. On the one hand, you've had central labor councils like around San Diego and Los Angeles passing resolutions in support of the Green New Deal. There's been other examples in Maine. I think SEIU might have just come out supporting the Green New Deal and so on. So there is a lot of support in the labor movement. On the other hand, you have, a lot of entrenched opposition, particularly in the building trades. The building trades, unfortunately, at times have been, you know, close to the oil and gas industry, the American Petroleum Institute. But I think it's important to try to not write anyone off, because in the long run, if something like the Green New Deal is going to succeed, it's going to have to figure out a way to bring in the labor movement. as a driving force, or maybe, you know, reinvent the labor movement. But it's been extremely disappointing, the reaction from some parts of the labor movement, definitely.
The building trades can always be relied upon to take the worst positions in all of organized labor. Finally, in my weaker moments, you know, I say I think that the climate situation is so dire that we would welcome help from the corporate sector, at least portions of the corporate sector. But there really isn't that much there. Is there?
Well, I agree with you. I think that the measures that the fossil fuel industry and that corporate America on the whole is getting behind are woefully insufficient. A carbon tax that's backed by Exxon and ConocoPhillips is clearly only going to go so far. And we really need a much more robust, bold, transformative vision that really, you know, just doesn't fall in line with the tastes, the preferences, and the interests of big corporations.
Did you say you had some things you might want to add?
Yeah. So I guess one thing I wanted to say is sort of a caveat and maybe one or two just juicy bits that you might have interest in including. I think it's important to remember that with these corporate-aligned environmental organizations, like the New York League of Conservation Voters, like the Environmental Defense Fund, and so on, there's a tension within them. There's a mixed bag. On the one hand, you have some of these organizations have 1 million or 2 million members, and these are mostly just ordinary people who see these groups and see their names and think they're supporting something good. And I think it's important to not alienate those people and to recognize that there's a lot of people that are tied, even staffers that are tied to these organizations with good intentions. But on the other hand, you have their funding sources and you have their board members and leaders that are pulling in the other direction. So I think it's important for the climate movement to try to continue to bring transparency to the conflicts of interest in these organizations and draw those out. But at the same time, try to win over the elements of the organizations that probably, if they knew what was going on, would much rather be donating their money to, say, 350.org or the Sunrise Movement rather than the Environmental Defense Fund.
Yeah, I did want to ask you, are there some good guys?
I think another important thing to bring in about the Environmental Defense Fund is that they have a partnership with the Carlyle Group that has lasted for several years now. The Carlyle Group, as your listeners might know, is one of the most powerful private equity firms in the country. They actually were the firm that bought up and actually bankrupted Philadelphia Energy Solutions, which owns the big oil refinery in Philadelphia that exploded a few weeks ago. They went in, you know, essentially stripped it and bankrupted it. And now they're still, I think, like an 8% or a 10% owner. It's been taken over by the banks. But, you know, this is a private equity firm that is directly invested in the fossil fuel industry. Another example is that Carlyle Group is financing a huge new export terminal near Corpus Christi in Texas that is going to be shipping out a bunch of the oil that's being drilled up and fracked in the Texas Permian Basin. So, you know, these are the types of characters that the EDF is greenwashing for, unfortunately.
I was Derek Seidman, a research analyst for Little Sis, an arm of the Public Accountability Project. You can find them on the web at littlesis.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break.
There's a woman in gold when you're old. Keep the members harder than you might suppose. Lately I tend to make strangers wherever I go. Some of them were once people I was happy to know. Mounting my lift on the dash, double darkness falling fast. I keep stressing, pressing on. Down some substratum, feels like something really wrong has happened.
Some of All My Happiness Is Gone from the new album by David Berman, flying under the name Purple Mountains. Berman, who was the genius behind the Silver Jews back in the 1990s and early 2000s, is curiously the son of the deeply evil Richard Berman, who's devoted much of his life to trying to destroy organized labor through front organizations like the Employment Policies Institute. Next, what have those giant corporate tax cuts actually done? Where did the money come from and where did it go? Here's Marshall Auerbach with some answers. Auerbach is a market analyst and a research fellow at the Levy Institute of Bard College. Marshall Auerbach. So the tax reform bill liberated those wrongfully imprisoned billions of dollars abroad. You know, one sheds a tear for all that wrongful imprisonment. What was that supposed to do for us?
Well, it was supposed to, as you say, it was supposed to, the funds were supposed to be liberated. And by liberated, it means they were free from punitive tax penalties, which actually nobody really paid. They were going to come back to the U.S., flood our shores, create loads of new investment and high-quality jobs, and turn us back into a powerful manufacturing republic. And, of course, none of that happened, which won't surprise you or your readers, or listeners, rather, that the whole thing was constructed on a tissue of lies. Surprise, surprise.
Where were these dollars physically? It's in so far as dollars have any physical existence. But, you know, people think of these like, you know, stashed in bank accounts abroad. But really, how is this money kept?
The money itself, funnily enough, is actually kept in U.S. bank accounts, mostly in the U.S. The idea that they're stored abroad is purely a function of accounting. They're classified as offshore dollars. But, for example, Apple had a lot of money which was classified as a lot of dollars which were classified as offshore that were actually held onshore run by an Arizona-based hedge fund. It was a deal that they worked out with the IRS. And many of these other venues where the money is supposedly held, Ireland, the Cayman Islands, Bermuda, they show up as being major holders of U.S. treasuries. And, of course, if you believe that Ireland or Bermuda have suddenly become economic superpowers, then that's very, very credible. But, in fact, we know that this is just an offshore venue where the treasuries held by these companies is held as it's a kind of domicile, even though, as I said, the money's is actually back in the U.S., but there's a sort of an accounting wall around it.
So are these large corporations, which mostly operate, you know, in the real world of goods and services, nonetheless become these gigantic financial entities with vast holdings. I recall some days Apple had more cash on its balance sheet than the U.S. Treasury did. What can we say about this kind of economics, where these large corporations have these vast pots of money that are just collecting interest and not doing much else?
Yeah, well, again, it's symptomatic of a much broader problem, and until we solve the broader problem, we're not going to solve the tax problem, which is to say that we've got an overly financialized economy dominated by financial interests, financial engineering. We used to do real engineering, now we do financial engineering. You know, the Japanese, I lived in Tokyo in the 1980s, and the Japanese had a name for this. It was called Zytec, which was essentially financial engineering, and the same thing now goes on with most of America's multinational corporations. You earn as much interest as you can through relatively risk-free arbitrage with the money. You then use it to minimize use the accounting to minimize the tax penalties. You also use it to buy back shares. There's been reports showing that there was massive increases in share buybacks and dividend payments to shareholders. But you don't tend to use it to fund research and development or any kind of investment in the U.S. That's really what happens, because it why would you? I mean, it's your CEOs get paid by increasingly by compensation by stock options, the stock market. So you have all sorts of incentives to enrich management by creating these huge cash piles and then letting the U.S. banks do something with it, which profits you ultimately, but not your workers.
A lot of this money, this vast corporate surplus that is not finding its way into employment or investment or R&D or anything that one thinks of as relatively benign uses of corporate funds, it seems to be finding its way into share buybacks, right?
Yes, that's correct. In fact, there was a very good article done by Anne-Marie Knott of Forbes.com, and she quantified the data for the first three quarters of 2008. We had buybacks of $583.4 billion, which was up 52.6% from 2017. By contrast, capital investment in aggregate was up only 8.8% over that same period. R&D was up about 12.5%. So some of the money was marginally used for what you might call quote-unquote real economic activity, but the vast majority was used for share buybacks or dividends, which were distributed back to shareholders by dividend payments.
Which just drives the stock market higher and which conveniently raises the value of the CEO stock options.
Exactly. So, and that's all tied up with the fact that we've got an overly financialized economy. And there's no reason, by the way, why we should allow share buybacks. Bill Lozonik has done some excellent work on this, and it used to be that was considered a form of stock price manipulation, but the rules were changed in 1982 under Ronald Reagan, and ever since that time, it's been it's been free money or free compensation for the CEO class.
Well, I guess this gets to a kind of philosophical question, but what is the point of accumulating all these assets that will never be used in any real world sense?
That's a great question. It goes beyond philosophy. What's the point of having CEOs making 300 times what its lowest paid worker does? I mean, it points to something that you've written about a lot of the times. You know, you have this massive appropriation of capital on by management at the expense of labor. It's been going on for a number of decades, and our system is so prone to political and regulatory capture that nothing's been done about it. So in that sense, with so much else with Trump, he's very, very clarifying, and he exposes stuff that's been out there for a long time, but it just becomes much more explicit under his presidency. And the tax reform, quote-unquote, is a perfect illustration of that.
Now, the official line, of course, was that U.S. corporations are overtaxed relative to their peers domiciled abroad. How much truth is there to that?
Well, that's complete BS. Congressional Research Office did a study back in 2014, which suggested that if you take the deductions and the usual credits, that the effective rate is about 27.1% in the U.S., the corporate tax rate, which is in line with what our European competitors pay. And even that probably overstates the amount of tax avoidance, legal tax avoidance that these corporations have, because most of them pay hardly anything at all.
Now, what's the result of this tax reform been? There are some really strange bookkeeping entries in the national income accounts at the end of 2017, beginning of 18, as they paid themselves big dividends. But what has the real-world effect of this liberation from imprisonment of these wrongfully confined dollars been?
Well, a tax avoidance, where the number of companies paying no tax at all doubled from 30 to 60 after the reform was enacted. That's the main thing. But the other thing is that there was a new 10.5% rate applied to global intangibles, such as patents, trademarks, copyrights. And it was thought that, well, at least you're going to be capturing something rather than nothing. But in fact, it doesn't work that way, because you could still reroute the money through various tax havens, Bermuda, the Dutch Antilles, etc. So these companies still end up paying virtually nothing. But in addition to that, it's actually provided incentives to accelerate offshoring in intangible things like factories, because if you're a pharmaceutical company and you want to claim the 10.5% rate, you strengthen your case with the IRS by increasing the number of factories that produce the stuff in Ireland. That creates a much stronger prima facie case that you actually are worthy of paying the 10.5% rate. So you don't come anywhere close to even the new and improved 21% tax rate.
Now, this all was supposed to be part of Trump's strategy for reviving U.S. manufacturing. It wasn't clear how that was going to work, but how is that working out?
Well, not very well is the honest answer. I mean, it's been great for a few corporations. You could argue again that, as is always the case with Trump, he introduced a very, very large fiscal stimulus, and some of that did leak into the broader economy, not much, but any fiscal stimulus is going to increase economic activity. I mean, the one good thing about Trump is he's not an austerian. Again, if you continue to shuffle the gains to the people with the highest savings propensities, those are the 1% or even the 0.1%, then the economy is not going to grow as efficiently, you ultimately don't get as much growth as you could if the gains were more broadly, if fiscal resources were more broadly deployed. And I think so. You don't even have to make a moral case that inequality is a bad thing. The main thing is the inequality is actually causing us to have a less efficient economy that's not growing as well as it could be.
Corporate profitability, although off its highs from a few years ago, is quite high by historical standards. You would think that would encourage investment because there are attractive rates of return. It's not the greatest economy the way Trump claims it is, but, by most conventional measures, they're looking pretty good. Why are we not seeing higher levels of investment in the real sector?
Because the reality is we've got a lot of global capacity, nobody really finds the need to invest in the U.S. right now, unless they're given a pile of tax abatements or incentives. I mean, you could look at the recent example of Amazon as an illustration of that. And also because they're not really interested in creating jobs, these companies. They are interested in generating profits because the compensation of management now is tied to the share price. It's not tied to how the performance of the underlying company. And as another illustration of this, tangentially, you could look at Boeing. I mean, Boeing now manufactures loads of disastrously and literally deadly products, but the stock price has gone up in the last decade by almost 500%, and the CEO gets paid on a very, very large basis for via stock options and stock the stock price. And likewise with General Motors, which just recently shut down 5 plants in the U.S., but the CEO of General Motors is the highest paid automobile executive in the world because she has a very large stock compensation package.
I'm speaking with the market analyst Marshall Auerbach. Well, even the steel industry, which is supposedly the beneficiary of Trump's tariffs, doesn't look to be thriving.
No, and that's another problem. I mean, I actually have some sympathy with Trump's view that we ought to try to re-domicile supply chains, bring them back home. But the way that he does it is through a curious 19th century style, McKinley style protectionism. He uses tariffs. And I think there are other more effective ways of actually redomiciling these supply chains. I have no problem with the idea of the government being used to help foster economic development. We used to do industrial policy very, very well. In fact, the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, I think, is a good illustration of the fact that, when we do direct government resources towards a common overriding purpose, we can do that quite well. But nobody's really interested in that anymore because it doesn't pay to do that. It's a bit like the line of, why do you rob the bank? Well, that's where the money is. Well, it's the same thing here. Well, why do you bother? Why would you bother in a reverse way? Why would you bother investing in the U.S. When you can just make money keeping it in the banking system?
Trump, of course, seems to think that foreigners are paying the tariffs. So people say that they try to convince him otherwise, but he can't be convinced. So maybe he thinks that we're putting one over on them.
Well, he also thought that Mexico would pay for the wall. So there you go. I mean, look, ultimately, in the first instance, I suspect with the tariffs, with the Chinese, for example, they won't pass on the increases. But I think increasingly they are beginning to pass on those increases because a lot of materials that they imported and exported before the tariffs were introduced, that's running out, and now the new prices are coming in. So I suspect Americans ultimately will pay more. It is a form of consumption tax, whether he likes to think of it or not that way.
the Times, New York Times had a story the other day about how Chinese investment in the U.S. is falling off because of this trade war. Is that something that people should be concerned about?
Well, not really. I mean, I personally would like to see a lot more U.S. investment in the U.S. The Chinese investment has been in stuff. It's been in very marginal areas like real estate, and I think also they use the investment to appropriate a lot of U.S. intellectual property. So I'm of the belief that our relationship with China, this so-called Chimerica Nexus, is not fundamentally healthy for the U.S. I do believe that it does make sense to revive, at least create a kind of recreate a manufacturing ecosystem as much as possible. I mean, look, there's all this talk about a Green New Deal right now, but we don't even have the engineering expertise domestically to implement a lot of the objectives that are in that program, and that's a real problem.
And so what would a better way be to, bring back the manufacturing that you were talking about?
Well, I'd like to see a more active government role. This isn't particularly controversial. We used to do this very well, right from the days of John Quincy Adams and his canal system. We had the New Deal. We had the highway program by Eisenhower, Kennedy's NASA lunar landing promoted activity. So national industrial policy didn't used to be a dirty word in this country. It has been for the last 30 or 40 years, and as we allowed government to become a vessel for corporate predation.
One can hear a Canadian accent here. your country used to, your home country used to be big on that kind of industrial policy, that kind of nationalist policy. It's given up on that too, right?
Yeah, I think most countries have. I mean, it's part of the whole, if you want to call it neoliberalism, I would prefer to call it market fundamentalism, that, these objectives are best left to the private sector, and the government shouldn't play a role except as umpire calling balls and strikes. Of course, it doesn't only do that. It shapes the conditions of the field and might bring in the fences to help certain hitters, if you want to extend the analogy. And that's not just in the U.S. As you say, it's also in Canada. You see it in Europe as well. The whole system of social democracy has been steadily eviscerated through German-imposed austerity throughout the continent. So it's an idea which hopefully will be revived, but the U.S. is by no means unique in that respect.
But the only kind of nationalism we seem to be seeing these days is a really snarling xenophobia.
Yeah, that's true. And that's because I think the left nationalism has been hijacked to some extent. It's been the left which has really been co-opted the most by this neoliberalism, this market fundamentalism. It started with Clinton, continued with Obama in this country. But even in the UK, Labour under Tony Blair and Gordon Brown used to extol the light touch of regulation. Those were Brown's words on their financial services and try to extend that approach throughout the world. Well, we saw how well that worked in 2008. But the reality is that there is still not much support on the left for a left sort of nationalism, and therefore it's been left in the hands of the demagogues and the neo-fascists like Trump.
You know, as you look at something like this, this piling up of trillions, literally trillions, I'm not exaggerating, of useless dollars in various tax shelter arrangements, it just seems like capitalism has reached a phase of utter decadence. You know, here we are facing an ecological crisis that threatens civilization itself, and, we have useless dollars piling up to avoid taxes. What is it about the upper bourgeoisie and taxes? They just seem to hate taxes more than anything else.
Yeah, they hate taxes, and they used to there used to be much greater rules towards enforcing them, but our whole approach towards the white collar class has now changed remarkably. It's interesting that a couple of days ago Robert Morgenthau died at he was almost 100 years old, and he was used to head he was Manhattan DA, and he also ran the SDNY. And he went after a lot of bad guys, literally organized crime. But he also vigorously prosecuted white-collar criminality, including tax evasion. And we've just given up on that. And that's not just unique under Trump. That's become a bipartisan phenomenon. It was particularly bad under Obama when he refused to put any bankers to jail. And so when you have that sort of an approach, you know, Trump might be represent the apotheosis of that kind of corporate predation, but he is by no means unique. And this is what happens when you stop enforcing the rule of law and start saying it's okay to evade your taxes, to cheat the system. We're not going to do anything about it. You know, it's Gresham's law. You know, bad money drives out good.
This is a bit out of left field, but
I'm happy to take him out of left or right field.
I read a couple of papers recently on the growth of index funds and the fact that a large portion of corporate America now is run just by is owned by index funds that invest passively in the S&P 500 or something equivalent. So the whole idea of the stock market as some kind of real-time report card on corporate policy or some kind of disciplinary measure, which I never bought in the first place, but you know that's the theory. That now is just empirically baseless now. I mean, the stock market now is just this like kind of run an automatic pilot, and it keeps going and going and higher and higher, and with none of this disciplinary governance function that it was supposed to have. So what use are these, is the stock market at this point?
Well, it's not. It's a wealth transfer mechanism, a very, very regressionary one, because what happens is that every time you have a stock market bubble, everyone thinks that they're going to benefit, and then, of course, the crash comes, and those that are at the top generally have the funds to buy from the distressed sellers at the bottom. So, you know, Joe Q public investor is going to get screwed. The largest people get completely enriched. In fact, one of the economists who I think has done the best work on global economic inequalities is Branko Mananovic. He's at CUNY these days, but he's done some excellent work showing that inequality has really accelerated as economies have gone become more financialized for precisely that reason, because financialization makes economies more prone to bubbles, and when bubbles burst, of course, as I said, you get people that have all the money buying the assets at distressed prices from those that are poor sellers. I mean, that's how Joe Kennedy really expanded his wealth back in the 1930s as one real-world example from many, many decades ago. And we've got that's effectively a situation that's being replicated today. And I suspect that we'll have another quantum leap in inequality when the stock market does crash again, as it certainly will at some point.
And despite having, you know, this vast pools of money, more money than it knows what to do with, corporate America is still borrowing a lot. What sense do you make of that, and what does that hold for the future?
First of all, debt is still favored under the tax system as opposed to equities. You get some benefits. It's been changed marginally under the tax reform, but you still get derive some benefits from debt. But the main thing is you borrow it's a good way of just helping to fund the stock buybacks. And as long as the incentives are skewed towards supporting higher and higher share prices, as long as we've got a cost of capital that's virtually nothing, that creates incentives towards increasingly reckless behavior.
Now, technically speaking, it would be easy to approach these problems. I mean, it's not politically very, very difficult, but technically speaking, you could limit buybacks, you could force corporations to disgorge more of this cash into useful activities. These are not technically overwhelming questions, right?
That's right. They're questions of political will. And as I pointed out earlier, the 1982 SEC law that was effectively overturned was what opened the gate towards stock buybacks. So you could easily reverse that rule. Of course, it would create bloody hell right now, and there'd be a million bankers who would, and accountants, et cetera, who would no doubt explain why this would create economic disaster. And it no doubt would create a big stock market discontinuity, which would be used to create pressures the other way. But as you say, this is a matter of a political will now, not technical difficulty.
That was Marshall Auerbach, a market analyst and research fellow at the Levy Institute of Bard College. I have to dissent from Marshall's call for a revived left nationalism. To me, nationalism is by nature exclusive, dividing people into in-groups and out-groups, which is not what the world needs in these days of polarization and climate crisis. I find the need for a left internationalism far more urgent. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, something from David Berman's previous project, The Silver Jews, this Random Rules from 1998. Till next week, bye.
In 1984, I was hospitalized for approaching perfection. Slowly screwing my way across Europe, they had to make a correction. Broken and smoking where the infrared earplugs in the digital space. I tell you, they make it so you can't shake hands. That's why it scared me so.